Let's go to biography. He's been described as the father of New Zealand composition. Douglas Lilburn was composer, conductor, critic and teacher whose work earned him our highest award, the Order of New Zealand. And he's taught many of the country's leading composers. He was a central player in the Kiwi art scene, and composer Philip Norman charted Douglas Lilburn's legacy in the book Douglas Lilburn, His Life and Music. And he's here today for our biography segment. Hi there, Philip.
Hello, Jesse.
Nice to meet you, and thank you so much for sharing your expertise. What was your connection to Douglas?
Well, I was a student of his, not in the sense that I sat at his knees and learnt how to compose, but in the sense that I studied his life and his works as a musicological student. So it was a historical thesis at a PhD level that I was really first introduced to his work.
Did you get to meet him?
Yes, I did. I started this thesis in 1978, I think it was. Douglas was still very much alive, well, and I won't say kicking, but very vital then. And yes, so I had quite a few interesting interviews from him. But funnily enough, such was the man, really. He preferred me to do most of my interviewing by, letter as it was back then, because he wanted to think about his responses before committing them to the hands of a student who was going to write about him. Very wise too, I think.
Yeah, could sympathise with that. He called himself the musician with the farmer's hands, so that maybe tells us something about his upbringing.
Fascinating, a lovely little phrase that. Yes, he came off a farm in the middle of the upper Turakina Valley, I think it is, somewhere east of Hunterville and a little bit south of Taihape. Is Taihape the place where they throw gumboots?
Right, yeah, that's the one.
Oh,
yeah.
Taihape, okay, got you. And it was beautiful countryside. One of the more memorable days of my life was spent staying on the Lilburn farm at Drysdale, just having a look around the area and enjoying the views of some beautiful waterfalls there and lush pastures, etc., etc. A charming, idyllic place to grow up, I'm sure.
Yeah, and some food for their creative mind later, probably.
I think so. He was the equivalent of an only child in sort of anthropological terms, I think they say. Where you're younger, your person older than you in the family is more than 5 years older, your childhood experience is almost that of an only child.
Wow.
He was a family of six or something, but there was this big gap between him and the person older than him. And so there's a lot of alone time imagining things. And I think that awoke his creativity because somewhere like that is not a cultural centre. So in a way, it's quite extraordinary that somebody came off a very isolated farm and was very interested in a particularly urban, people-centred occupation like composing for orchestras.
But when did he get interested in music then?
Well, he went to university. He went to Waitaki Boys High School down in Oamaru there, because at the time they had a remarkable headmaster called Frank Milner, who was noted for turning boys into men, as only those schools were able to do way back then.
He would have been almost contemporary with Jack Lovelock, maybe. I think he was at Waitaki Boys, wasn't he?
You were ahead of me there, but
no,
Lilburn was there in the 30s.
Yeah, okay. Now, Lovelock was in Berlin, winning gold medals in the 30s, so maybe he was a bit later. Sorry, carry on. But he got interested in music there.
Well, he started playing the piano, and a visiting pianist played at the school, and Lilburn remembers that as being the first time that he really wanted to be a musician. But he really didn't compose in any mature sort of sense until he was at University of Canterbury College in 1936. A flamboyant Australian composer called Percy Grainger arrived in town in New Zealand and challenged the New Zealand Broadcasting Service, as it was then, to hold a competition for a local composer to compose something for orchestra. Lilburn had never written anything for orchestra before, but he gave it a go, and he won. And that was really when his career started and took off as a composer at the age of, I think he would have been 19, 20, then. So,
And for most people living in this era, the Second World War plays a pretty big part, but what was his involvement, if any?
Well, he was over in London at the time they declared war. He had been studying there for 3 years at the Royal College of Music in London. War was declared, and he tried to enlist over there, but his eyesight wasn't up to army standards, and so he volunteered for the Air Force. I forget what they call them, you know, the armed wardens that would patrol the streets. But of course, at the start of World War II, it was the phony war and nothing much happened while Hitler decided to carve up the eastern countries. And London was left alone, during which time his parents older brothers called him back home to help on the farm because there was a shortage of manpower on the well, the Lilburns had several farms in the family.
Gee, it would have been quite a change from the Royal College of Music, I imagine, heading back to the farm to milk cows.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, it was way back to the solitary run. This was a farm near Tai Happy, and he has really pleasant memories of it, but memories like singing at the top of his voice on the top of a windswept hill with nobody around for miles but the sheep and the cows to listen to him. So, yes, a far cry from the madding crowd of London, maddening crowd.
Okay, corrections. Thanks, everyone. Lovelock went to Timaru Boys High.
Oh, that would be why I hadn't heard of it.
Yes, that's right. I'll stay out of it. Okay, so let's start with some of his early recordings. And I know that you sort of group his compositions into a few different eras, but we're going to start with Sings Harry. So where does this fit in?
Well, almost on the cusp between his first years and first period and his second period, where he started to explore different techniques in music, but it's very definitely a first period composition in the sense that it's very tonal, modal, and is speaking of New Zealand concerns, which it had to really, because he chose Dennis Glover's wonderful sequence of poems, Sings Harry, and that was all about a Backblocks character who strummed his old guitar to the cabbage trees.
Okay, here it comes.
These songs will not stand. The wind and the sand will smother.
RNZ National. We're learning about the life of Douglas Lilburn today in our biography segment with Philip Norman, and playing some of his compositions too. You describe his first early compositions as nationalistic or nationalist. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's a sort of leading word, really. He wasn't a patriotic tub thumper. He was more somebody who was really intent on trying to capture the essence of New Zealand or being a New Zealander in music. And it was all part of trying to develop a separate cultural identity to the motherland Britain back then. And one of the ways that Lilburn tried to do it was to capture the essence and the ambience of the physical environment. New Zealand being, in European Pākehā terms, a very young country, we didn't have the resource to centuries-old folk songs that European countries did. And so Lilburn back then decided that there was no commonality between his heritage and the Maori heritage. So initially he didn't make any use of the Maori heritage, but rather tried to capture the drama of the landscape in his music.
He was doing pretty well in Christchurch as a guest conductor at this time as well.
Oh, yes, he settled in Christchurch, funnily enough, in a flat that is now on the site of the town hall, Christchurch Town Hall. There's a plaque there, which I was delighted to be instrumental in laying there. And in the aftermath of that, thanks to some very sympathetic city councillors, the Christchurch Town Hall Auditorium was renamed the Douglas Lilburn Auditorium, which is what is known as today. But yes, he had a very successful time in Christchurch. In fact, Christchurch citizens would probably say that his best music was written down there, and it all went downhill when he went to Wellington. But
yeah, they would say that, wouldn't they? Yeah. Well, there were a few people. There were a few people around at that time in Christchurch: Alan Curnow, Rita Angus.
Oh, it was a fantastic time.
Yeah.
Yes, the list goes on and on, especially in the visual arts. But yeah, Dennis Glover was another one who was there. And so on and so forth. But yes, the that was the period where he was really trying to capture New Zealandness in his sound. And I don't think their jury has ever considered that it is practical to literally capture the environment in a musical sound. But certainly for a good many years, Lilburn's sound from that period in time came to represent a New Zealand sound, even though to an outside listener it probably sounded like an English composition or even a Finnish one, because Sibelius was quite an influence on his Lilburn's work at that time.
What about the second period, internationalism and serialism, you call it?
Yes, well, he discovered, he was sort of rather forced down this track by his mentor and colleague, head of department, Freddie Page, who really liked ultra-modern contemporary music and insisted that everybody around him at least give it a go at listening to. And so Lilburn felt that he had to get up to date, and he experimented with things called 12-tone music, which is basically a row of 12 notes, none of which are the same, and you have to write your music going in a particular order without repeating any notes until you've gone through all 12. It was a way of composers making sure that you couldn't hear any key in their music, a device, if you like, for making sure you sounded discordant. Well, Lilburn experimented with that, but it really wasn't his natural language. He was a composer that liked to be in charge of his music rather than his music being in charge of what he was writing.
Mm, that's a good way of putting it. We're going to play something from the National Orchestra, Symphony No. 3. What are we sort of listening for here?
Well, it was considered really radical at the time. The first few notes of it, if you're diving in at the deep end, or is at the shallow end, I'm not quite certain, but diving in at the beginning, you can, if you listen really intently, hear one of these rows, note rows, but I wouldn't try and count them. To us now, it's quite a tonal, melodious piece. It certainly wasn't the discordant, agitating sound that the audiences in the early 1960s felt. Just listen back and admire the technical craft.
We are waiting. No, not having any luck with that one. So we'll have to try and find another one instead. I was quite looking forward to it too with your introduction. I imagine electronic music in the 60s, Philip, would have sounded pretty weird to people who had only ever heard the orchestra, but Lilburn was pretty keen to try out these sort of new techniques.
Yes, he was. I think he decided that that was his way out of having trying to write music that took control of the composer rather than the other way around was not for him. But he found in electronic music, especially what they call musique concrete, to really badly pronounce a French phrase, which was essentially mixing sounds from the environment and sometimes with some electronic work as well. He was able to pinpoint the environment, particular sounds, and pull them into his compositions. And that had an obvious appeal, as you would imagine, for somebody who'd been searching to create a New Zealand sound in this first period. The first major work that came out of that was one that he set a poem by Alistair Campbell to, called The Return. And in that you can hear, it's very simple, but a very effective sort of sound wash in the background of seagulls and the sounds of surf. And then you get a narrator who starts talking in mysterious languages, which actually turned out to be a list of Maori tree names. It is very atmospheric, and I think works really well as a piece, even though it's very early elementary electronics at that stage. I don't know what piece
we've got Carousal here.
Carousel, actually.
Sorry.
That's fine. It does. Actually, I prefer the way you pronounce it. Carousel, that sounds good.
Sounds a bit sexy when I do it, yeah.
Well, I don't know about the sexy thing, but yes. Here he's in a zany sort of a mood, and this is those electronic instruments that came out in the late 60s and 70s that really you had no control over. You press a key and sort of random modulations of sound would come out. So like all early computers, you didn't get what you wanted what you got. And so he would work with these sort of quite arbitrary sequences that would come out, and in this case it's quite a crazy little number.
Yeah, sounds good. As I say, pretty wacky for the time, I imagine.
Yes, you can just guess how the traditional symphonic audiences thought of what he was doing at that time.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, if any of his music is surviving in a big way now amongst the youth, it is those early electronic pieces. He's become something of a sort of father figure to the ambient music composers who look back at his early works using the environment and use them as sort of models, really.
I imagine it takes a certain lack of ego to tear up the what you know about composition and everything that you know that you're good at and embrace this new electronic form. I mean, I suppose artists like to create using whatever technology is available, but is it a big step to step away from the orchestra and into something like we just heard?
Oh, a huge step, really. Most creative artists manage one sort of sweeping change to their style in a lifetime, and some actually don't even manage that. They start off and they stay the same. But Lilburn managed it twice, really. And I think it was all to do with he had, in a sense, had a split personality. I'm talking metaphorically here, but he liked his traditional tonal music, and he would listen to Bach before he'd listen to contemporary music. But on the other hand, being part of the lecturing tradition, the intellectual side of him felt it really important that he lead the way in exploring new sounds. Mm. So he was sort of caught in this between the mind and the heart, if you like, the brain and the heart. And the brain kept on winning out most of the time. But funnily enough, one of the loveliest pieces he wrote was just shortly before he died. In fact, he didn't write anything after a certain period, but 15 years later, he wrote this piece in honour of his old piano that had kept him company right through his career. And it's just a simple tonal whole series of arpeggios just up and down the piano. And it's really rather moving. So in the end, his heart for his music won out, not just in that, but also in his funeral, where he didn't have a single note of music from the 20th century. It was all back to Bach.
Yeah. He was a teacher as well as a composer, had an influential role, in fact, probably a formative role at Victoria University School of Music.
Yes, well, when he arrived, his presence doubled the university department because there was only Fred Page there at the time. And Fred Page was a bit of a renegade for that time, in fact, for any time, really. And he, instead of getting some academically trained harmonist to teach the students harmony, he felt it would be much better to get a composer. I think he had a metaphor. He loved having metaphors with plumbers in them. And he had something like, if you want to get some plumbing done, then get a plumber. Don't get a different sort of person. So you want to get harmony taught, you get a composer who actually practically uses the harmony. And that was his reason for appointing Lilburn at that time. And that step actually persuaded most of the universities eventually to fall in line with that, to employ composers as teachers of music and harmony and counterpoint rather than academics.
We do have some clips of Lilburn speaking. This one's from 1975, and here he's talking to another famous name in musical education, Jack Boddy. This is him talking about his profession.
Oh, lovely.
When you have to fill in your tax form, under occupation, do you put composer?
No, in fact, I don't. I would use a word like musician, which seems to have a general coverage of what I do, and the word's readily understandable to anybody, even tax collectors.
Have you never used the term composer?
Oh, yes, I'm sure I did, especially in early years, because I think when one's young, one takes oneself much more seriously, and it seemed quite a natural thing to do then.
Did you find at any point that you felt that you had to assert yourself as a composer, as a valid profession?
It was perhaps a bit of a strange occupation when I began it here, but on the other hand, as a student in London, it seemed a perfectly natural thing to be, and later in Christchurch, there was a large group of people who took themselves quite seriously as painters, as writers, as poets, and musicians. And so it seemed to me quite a natural thing to set up business as a composer then.
What do you think are the responsibilities of being a composer?
I think by and large, like those of being anything else, one gains a lot during the course of a career, and certainly I think you have to return what you are given. This is why people in professions do a certain amount of teaching, I think. This is a way of maintaining a tradition that you both get from it and give back to it constantly.
It's Douglas Lilburn talking about his life and career. Philip Norman is in. Philip's his biographer, and he has a book on Douglas Lilburn if you're keen for more. We've barely scratched the surface today. I want to play a bit of the Aotearoa Overture, which I understand is his most famous composition. Could you say something to introduce this, Philip?
Oh, yes, certainly. But firstly, may I say how wonderful it was to hear those two voices again.
Yeah. He's got a beautiful voice, Lilburn, isn't he?
Yes. That's the standard voice for those artists who grew up in the 30s and 40s. Yeah. Very BBC, very clipped.
Yeah.
Jack's voice, of course, is very mellow, and you can start to hear the Asian influence coming into some of his clipness. But thank you for taking me back in time with that. The Aotearoa Overture, Lilburn wrote it for the 1940 centennial celebrations that were going to take place in London. He wrote it on spec for an orchestra that Braithwaite, forget his first name now, Warwick Braithwaite, was going to be conducting at the Covent Garden Orchestra. So he didn't call it Aotearoa Overture himself. That was suggested to him by Warwick Braithwaite, so all those people who have been trying to discover the New Zealandness in Lilburn's music, seizing on the Aotearoa Overture, got it all wrong because it was entitled after the event. But anyway, nonetheless, it has become it has come to conjure up New Zealandness. So when you talk about New Zealandness in music, most people think of this magical opening bars that I hope you're going to play.
Thanks so much, Philip Norman.